at the North Plains Seniors Center, and the date here is May 3, Thursday. And we thought we'd bring the tape recorder and visit with folks here at the Senior Center. It's my good fortune to run across a gentleman here who I think can tell us quite a little bit about this area around North Plains, Glencoe, and so on. Now, Glencoe is kind of the focal point of this tape in that we're trying to get more information about the little city of Glencoe. All right, now, first for the statistical department, let's call it, let's meet this gentleman over here and get his name, and then we'll take it from there. My good friend, give me your name, sir.
J.J. Millett.
And we spell that last name?
M-I-L-L-E-T.
Mm-hmm. All right. And what's the first moniker that you go by here?
Here at the center, everyone calls me J.J. since that's my initial. But
J.J.
My name is Joseph Julius.
Right, right. J.J. It seems somebody in TV that's a J.J. I don't know. Is it the sheriff on some show or something? Well, let's go into that. Well, J.J., you've been around these parts a long time. You might give us a little history. I believe you told me before we turned the tape machine on that you came from Switzerland. Is that correct, sir?
Originally, yes, sir. I came to Portland May the 10th, 1900, with my mother.
Mm-hmm. Now, was that on a sailing vessel by any chance?
Oh, definitely. I couldn't swim.
I bet that was a trip.
We were 11 days on the ocean. I always remember that, and that boy was I seasick.
Did you tell me how old you were when you came over?
Yeah, I was 3 years old. I was born 1897, you can figure it.
All right, I'll have to get my calculator out and figure that later. All right, and you came over on a sailing vessel, and...
You want the name of it?
Yeah, why not?
The name was La Lorraine. We left Le Havre, France, and landed in New York.
Now, registered to what country?
France.
French vessel. Well, now, were you a part of a group of immigrants, or...?
No, just my mother and I.
I'm just curious, what enticed your mother to take a hard trip in those days, that's for sure. What caused her to come over, sir?
Well, I wish I knew the answer to that. I've thought of it many times myself. But my mother had been to America. Her father, my grandfather, and her brother, my uncle, had a farm in Omaha, Nebraska in the 1800 and something. I couldn't give you the dates there because that's for my time. Then she went back to Switzerland later and married, and that's where I happened along then in 1897. And for some reason or other, your question, which I wish I could answer, has often popped into my mind, why did she do what she did? Because in those days, women did not, first of all, leave their men, and secondly, they didn't leave the countries. To take off from Switzerland to the wild and woolly West certainly took some kind of a huge push.
No,
what it is,
indeed,
I don't know.
Oh, goodness, yes, that's for sure.
You
came into New York, I would presume.
We came across the Rocky Canadian Pacific. I remember coming through the Rocky Mountains, and like I said, landed in Portland May the 10th, 1900. It's rather hazy for me because I wasn't three until that November.
Well, it wasn't much of a town, I don't suppose, at that time
not.
Either. All right, sir. All right, now, we got you into Portland. And did you and your mom, how did you work your way out here, sir?
Well, first off, she was a professional cook, had learned her trade in Switzerland, in the French part of Switzerland and France, worked for various nobility. And consequently, when she came here, her talents were much desired by some of the leading Jewish people in Portland, predominantly Julius Meyer, for whom she worked about 13 years, and later on another 13 years for Aaron Frank, and in that type of people of that caliber.
No, she was a professional cook.
She was a professional professional cook and had something to offer that the Jewish people are great eaters, you know, and she had what they liked.
Well, now, I suppose she spoke French?
French, and Swiss, and German, and English.
And English, so she was bilingual, that's for sure. All right. Now, let's get you right out here in the Willamette Valley, right out here around North Plains, sir. Did you come out to farm, or how did that all came about?
Well, we'll start back in 1907. My mother, I did not mention in the first place, I have a brother, and he was left. There again is a big mystery. As you can figure from the date that I gave you, and my brother's 2.5 years younger than I am, and he was left out there again for some some unknown reason that I cannot explain. And he lived in a different part of Switzerland than I was born, in Canton Aargau. That's a different canton or state. And so my mother decided that she wanted to get him, and in the spring of 1906, we took off for Switzerland and went back and stayed there 11 months. And when we terminated our visit, my brother and I and mother came back to Portland. Mm-hmm. That was 1907.
I see. Well, now, do you come back to farm or your...
No, we lived in Portland. She rented a little house and again did some catering work. And I can give you the address, and that was 655 Quimby Street, North Portland.
How about that?
Yeah, I have a picture of the house. Just a little modest little cottage. And then the next step, we went, we started the dairy farm out at Fairview, Oregon, around the upper end of Blue Lake, which is now and has been for many years a resort, and kind of most people know about it, until the high water. Then in 1911, we lost everything we had, and we hired a barge to move our cattle over to the Ruby Stock Farm over on Section Line Road near Gresham. And I finished my eighth grade school and going to Gresham grade school. And then my mother and brother went to Southern Oregon, worked for a man who had the Lace House Laundry in Portland. I can't recall his name. And I went to Washougal to high school. I milked my way partly through high school.
Mm-hmm. So you know how to get it out the old-fashioned way.
Very definitely. I've got marks to show for it here.
You bet you, sir.
45 cows.
Boy. Now, one of the things, now you've lived actually, let's get you right here in the North Plains area. How long have you been here, sir?
My first visit out here, came out here just before I went to high school in Washington. That was 1910. My uncle, Adolf Zwimpfer, Zwimpfer, for here, had a farm. Zwimpfer. And he bought 32 acres of land just north of the town site of North Plains, over which is now adjoining a substation, a PGE substation. And so I came out to help out, cutting wood and one thing or another, in my spare time. Mm-hmm. And then due to that contact, my mother wound up by buying a farm up in Shady Brook. And my uncle knew of it and informed her, and she came from Southern Oregon. So that was the reason why I had to quit high school to come out and take over that hill farm. And that's how we came out to this country.
So you were in Washougal, he was in Washougal from 1911
until when?
1911, 1912.
Did you know anybody named Moore? Carl Moore and Frank Moore?
Carl Moore and Frank Moore?
The people that I lived with in Washougal was Carl Goot, G-O-O-T. Mm-hmm. He was an old-timer there and had a big dairy farm and had been there a good many years. He, too, came from Switzerland originally.
I see. Well, now let's zero in here on the big city of Glencoe.
What year did he buy the farm?
My mother bought it in 1914.
All right. Now, sure, you have recollections, I'm sure, of the big city of Glencoe. Is that right, sir?
Well, it was already gone.
Well, of course, it was already on the way out because North Plains had started in 1910, and I do remember they moved a Woodman of the World Hall from Old Glencoe. It was in transit long about in 1914, mm-hmm. and was eventually landed in North Plains, and since then, of course, has been eliminated. It's an older building. It's torn down. Mm-hmm. But the store, the Mays Brothers store, had already been moved from Glencoe to North Plains, and I can't give you the exact date, but approximately 1911.
He's very good.
All right.
He's very good.
All right.
Mays Brothers.
And J.R. Mays was the father of all the Mays Brothers. He was in the store at Old Glencoe, and when they moved to North Plains later on, J.R. Mays was on a farm up at Yam Hill because the boys felt that he was not competent to run a store or anything, so he turned it over to his boys, who were middle-aged men at that time, mm-hmm. and then he moved up to Yam Hill, and later on came back to North Plains in the last two or three years of his life, and my first wife, Fay O. Bills, whose mother was a Mays, took care of him until he passed away. Don't know that date.
All right. Now, Mays, this name Mays has been sticking in my mind. You mentioned it earlier before we started tape. I had a Mays, that was a big store back in Denver, I believe, Mays department store or something. I wonder if it's the same Mays. I don't know.
I think there's just one letter difference. That was May Company.
Oh, May That's Company. Yeah, I had a grandfather that drove, you deliver stuff with May. Oh, you're right. Mays. You're right, my friend. You've straightened me out on that. All right.
Incidentally, the May Company is the one that bought out Meyer and Franks, and they're still in control. They're the biggest corporation going, as near as I know. That's the same May Company.
Oh, I'll be doggone.
Yes.
I never have. Half an hour.
All right.
It's okay.
Well, I think to kind of tape... Pardon me, sir?
We want to know more about the Mays. Marion Mays was a banker when they started the local bank here, and Mr. Beach was the principal stockholder at that time, and a few others of us, including me. I had a $20 interest in that bank myself.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, I understand it finally sold out to Hillsborough Commercial.
Yes.
Well, now that's off mic, Ruth.
Incidentally, there's a step in between there if you want that, and that's the Shoot Bank of Cornelius. They took over first, and then the Hillsborough Commercial National bought out the Shoot and its various holdings.
All right.
I didn't lose my point.
Now, did we get that, Ruth, all straightened out, who the banks are and one thing and another? Yeah.
And Elmer Mays was active in the store, and then Marion Mays' son-in-law, Lester Cipher, L.R. Cipher, he was the manager of the Mays Brothers for a while, and then later on his brother, Henry Cipher, came into the store.
Well,
his father, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, he was neighbor to my mother. So yes.
Okay, all right.
They lived in two locations.
It'd be interesting. I know you also remember other old-timers that in the early days here in North Plains. Do you have some other names that come to mind, sir? That
Meek.
Oh, sure.
Well, everybody knew the Meeks. There were a lot of them. Bob Meek, especially. He was the oldest one of the Meek boys, and then, of course, later on, Johnny Meek worked for me. I drove a logging truck with hauled piling. Johnny Meek was my co-pilot. We had a steering trailer. That's why we call them co-pilots. And I knew various men and women of the Meek family, in fact, the whole family, through the years. And I still know the remaining ones that live here locally. Ruth Gates was one, of course. And Gertie Meek, she lives in California. Her name is Cantonwine. I visited them occasionally. And then there was Jimmy. He was killed in a plane. He was a duster, and he was the youngest Meek boy, and he died in a plane crash in California a number of years ago.
I see. Look, I have a rundown there on the Meeks.
Now, was S.A.D. Meek dead by the time you came
here? S.A.D.? Oh, no, I knew old Steve.
The father of the
That's the father. That was Steve. Also,
no,
there was a son.
That's the famous Joe Meek that went down to Shampooey. And
yes,
all
yes,
that.
Definitely.
He would have been the grandfather.
Yes, yes. Now, there are several other Meeks around there. You know, there's a, I don't know just how many are left here, but there's a Joe Meek, and he does not live in the area, but he owns some of the original Meek farm up near Mountaindale.
Oh, is that where it was?
Joe, and then Clarence passed away last week. His wife, Eva, his widow, comes here regularly.
Well, inasmuch as you knew the famous Joe Meek.
No, I didn't know him.
Oh, no, you didn't know the...
Steve's father.
That was Steve's father, yeah. I'm trying to make you younger all the time here. You know, maybe it's too old. I don't know which.
Keep working at it.
Keep working at it. Yeah. All right. Well, Ruth, can you think of any other little?
Well, I wondered if you ever met any of the McKays.
Did you meet any of the McKays?
Now, as far as the McKay people are concerned, when your name was mentioned here the first visit you were here, and I missed you. Why, I made up my mind then the best information I could give you authentically would be some of the one of the several abstracts that I have of property that I bought around here, and it goes back, of course, to the McKay donation claim, section 1.
I'd like to know where it is.
And I have that in my possession somewhere, but I didn't expect you today. I think I have it at home.
We'll be coming again.
I'd be happy to transfer that. That will give you some authentic dates as to when the donation land claim started here.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Now, do you know what the boundaries of that, how many acres they had in their first claim?
Well, in the original donation land claim, presumably it was 640 acres.
Mm-hmm.
And I also happen to have maps, since I worked for the State Board of Forestry for a number of years, and it showed the original donation land claims. However, this map was made in 1928, but the original donation claims were all on it, and then later on was divided by the beaches and the different ones around here.
Where was the Meek House, do you know?
Yes,
it's just... Is it
still... The Meek House is still just...
Not Meek, McKay.
McKay House.
No, that I don't know.
Oh,
no.
Okay.
No, it'd be interesting to know about the Meek House, too.
The Meek House was located here in North Plains, was it, or close
no,
to
No, it's about a little more than halfway towards Mountaindale. It would be on, well, I can't tell you, it's right in the turn of a road. There's a quite, it's just beyond the old Pumpkin Ridge Road, which left North Plains to the west and then turned north. And then instead of where it turns north, you continued westward. In fact, that land right at that intersection, I think Clarence Meek added to the original Meek place.
I see. Ruth, can you think of any other little tidbits we might get here while we're visiting with this gentleman?
No, you eliminated one old landmark, and that was the old blacksmith shop at Glencoe, which was owned by my father-in-law, Charles Walter.
Oh, was he your father-in-law?
Yes, ma'am.
And your brother-in-law, to
Bert and Edward,
yeah,
yes. Did you talk to Bert?
He has talked to him some.
Well, he should know. He was born and still lives right...
But, of course, he's young enough that he doesn't remember the McKay.
Yeah,
he
was born in 1900.
Yeah. What was it? He told us that who was it that the first people... We wrote that down.
Yeah, we wrote it. We have it written down
he
somewhere.
He shot a horse for Mrs. McKay, wasn't it?
Yeah, he shot a horse for...
Charlie McKay. The first customer he had was Mrs. McKay. She brought her...
That's why when you asked me about the father or grandfather, that had to be Charles Walter and this McKay guy
mm-hmm.
himself.
Do you know how old that old house is next to the blacksmith shop? I'm just curious.
I can't give you that in years, but when Charles Walter took it over in 1890 on July the 4th, he took it over from a man named Wirtz, Joe Wirtz, W-I-R-T-Z. And Joe Wirtz was not the original man. There was a man before him in the early 18-something that I don't know about.
My goodness, that house goes back a long ways.
Was he also the blacksmith?
Yes, worse.
He was the second one.
But that house now, of course, is not the original house because Charles Walter added considerable to it after he got
I believe
married.
He told me that one day he'd added to it.
But it does go back then before 1830.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Well, Ruth,
they had a lodge building adjacent to the house, which belongs to the Walter property now. And like I said, it was a Woodman Hall. That was moved. And at one time, there was a saloon there also. And that was that saloon, one of the operators was Henry Johnson. I remember that. And he's an old-timer, too.
They never have mentioned the saloon. They must not
oh, boy.
I can tell you something about that saloon.
I've got a little time here. Of course, to me, it's hard to talk about Scotsman very long without talking about maybe a saloon.
Well, this doesn't pertain to the saloon particularly, except the location. And Mr. Johnson, who is the saloon keeper there, at one time was approached by one of the farmers, I can't recall his name, and he wanted to borrow $600. And Henry said, well, okay. He said, it's in a bucket down in the basement. Go down and get it. And the man went down to the basement, and he got his $600 in gold coins and went about his business. And that fall, he came back to Henry and said, well, Henry, I brought back your $600, and here it is. Henry said, well, Jack, you know where you got it. He said, go ahead and put it where you got it. And that's the way they did business in those days.
Oh, thank you. That's wonderful. I love this. This is great. Well, I think we all should thank this good gentleman for just a wonderful visit here, by golly.
Well, I wish you many things that will pop up after.
Oh, sure. You betcha.
If you get interested in North Plains and Austin.
I think maybe...
Have you ever talked to Mr. Matthews over at the Historical Society or anybody from there?
No, I don't.
Oh, we're going to turn your name in, that's for sure. You betcha. Hey, I got to sign this off here. Well, this is just some little tidbits that we picked up during our visit here on May the 5th, 1984, when we paid a visit to the North Plains Senior Center. I'll just let you kind of carry on there, if you will, sir.
Well, getting back to the old blacksmith shop at Glencoe, I can't give you the exact year, but somewhere's in the neighborhood of 14 or 15, there was a stack of worn-out horseshoes, between 5 and 6 feet in diameter, and higher than my head, which would be over 6 feet tall, that Charlie would toss out the worn-out shoes and gradually accumulate them, and eventually sold to some junk dealer that came by. And they hauled them away. What they did with them, I never did know, because it's comparatively poor iron. The other incident that comes to mind was the old tire setter in the back of the shop, used in setting up these old heavy 3.5-inch wagon tires, as they loosen, of course, in the summer and they get worn. And eventually, it took up so much room and became useless, because people didn't use the old farm wagon anymore. So again, the junk man came by and wanted to buy that iron for junk prices. Charlie, being kind of a sharpie, told me after, he said, you know, I just wondered if he was going to take that someplace and they'd set it up and use it again. So I decided I would sell him the entire setter except the big bolts that go in, which is the life of the whole operation. So I retained the bolts so he could not sell it for future use again. And that was the other incident that came to my mind.
JJ, how big of bolts were they, sir?
Those bolts were about, it looked to me to be about 3 inches in diameter, very fine thread they used to tighten up the tire on these big old worn wagon wheels.
Just a couple more tidbits here from our good friend JJ.
office.
Well, here comes number three now. Something J.J. Comes to his memory. Go ahead, J.J.
Another little incident concerning Charles Walter. He said, way back when, and he was called upon to repair an engine at over in Forest Grove, and so numerous people had looked at it and couldn't do anything about it. So he looked it all over and stood there with his hands in his pockets, never touched a thing, and discovered what it was, next to nothing, a line of trouble. And so he was asked, after he fixed it, he was asked, well, how much was it? Well, he said, $25. Well, gee, that was quite a bit of money. Well, just what do you base the charge on? Well, he said, the fellow says, you didn't do anything much. Well, that's true, Charlie said. But we'll say it was $24.75, he said, for knowing how, and 25 cents for doing it.
Very good. Very good, JJ. Thank you. Call this part two of our visit with JJ here because he has recalled a couple of stories here concerning the old blacksmith shop at Glencoe. And so we've flipped the tape over here to side B to pick up a couple of more tidbits about this blacksmith shop. So JJ, I'll just let you kind of carry on there if you will, sir.
Well, getting back to the old blacksmith shop at Glencoe, I can't give you the exact year, but somewhere's in the neighborhood of 14 or 15, there was a stack of worn-out horseshoes, between 5 and 6 feet in diameter and higher than my head, which would be over 6 feet tall, that Charlie would toss out the worn-out shoes and gradually accumulate them and eventually sold to some junk dealer that came by, and they hauled them away. What they did with them, I never did know, because it's comparatively poor iron. The other incident that comes to mind was the old tire setter in the back of the shop, used in setting up these old heavy 3.5-inch wagon tires, as they loosen, of course, in the summer and they get worn. And eventually, it took up so much room and became useless because people didn't use the old farm wagon anymore. So again, the junk man came by and wanted to buy that iron for junk prices. Charlie, being a kind of a sharpie, told me after, he said, I just wondered if he was going to take that someplace and they'd set it up and use it again. So I decided I would sell him the entire setter except the big bolts that go in, which is the life of the whole operation. So I retained the bolts so he could not sell it for future use again. And that was the other incident that came to my mind.
JJ, how big of bolts were they, sir?
Those bolts were about, looked to me to be about 3 inches in diameter, very fine thread they used to tighten up the tire on these big old worn wagon wheels.
Just a couple more tidbits here from our good friend JJ. Well, here comes number three now, something J.J. Comes to his memory. Go ahead, J.J.
Another little incident concerning Charles Walter. He said, way back when, and he was called upon to repair an engine at over in Forest Grove. And so numerous people had looked at it and couldn't do anything about it. So he looked it all over and stood there with his hands in his pockets, never touched a thing, and discovered what it was, next to nothing, a line of trouble. And so he was asked, after he fixed it, he was asked, well, how much was it? Well, he said, $25. Well, gee, that was quite a bit of money. Well, just what do you base the charge on? Well, he said, the fellow says, you didn't do anything much. Well, that's true, Charlie said, but we'll say it was $24.75, he said, for knowing how, and 25 cents for doing it.
Very good. Very good, JJ. Thank you.